I now have the pleasure of introducing Peg Noapfel. She's the associate editor of Illinois Issues, a magazine of state politics in the Springfield area. She published a chapbook of poems and is now working on a novel about a moose who loves Holiday Inns. She's one of the founders of Brainchild, a women's writing group in Springfield, which recently celebrated their first decade. This evening marks the return of Peg Noapfel to the St. Louis area where she lived for a time. I would now like to present Peg Noapfel.
This story I'm going to read from really is about a moose, a real Northwood, Maine moose who likes Holiday Inns and everything else that is plastic in America. And I was surprised to find myself writing this, but I think it goes back to when John and I lived in St. Louis. And at the end of a long, hot summer, we used to pile all the children into the car and drive off to Edwardsville or St. Joseph's, Missouri, to a Holiday Inn, which we'd pay for with our Visa card. And then we'd sit around and we'd say, hey, there was this moose that liked Holiday Inns. And we'd start telling each other stories. And so I figured if we kept doing this, there must be something in it. Okay, the first part I'm going to read you is sort of from the beginning of the book, and it kind of gets you into the mind of the moose. And there's nothing here that is mysterious except this mysterious box, which I unfortunately don't explain. It has $1 million in it, but nobody knows because it's all covered with moss. About 30 years after the old moose's accident, the U.S. Forest Service sent teams into the North Woods to survey the feeding habits of the larger cervidae. Assigned to Five Finger Lake was a Princeton student, age 19, named Philip Colby. Colby's parents had good connections. That's why he got the job. A desultory tennis player and an unenthusiastic student of American literature, Colby was not qualified for much of anything, let alone a stint in the wilderness. What he wanted very simply was to get away from home for a while. Also, he thought he might enjoy surviving in the woods. And so, with his usual good luck, he found himself in early June sitting on the shore of a remote lake, his elbow propped, if he had only known it, against the side of the old iron box. His duties, as outlined in the instruction sheet, were to mark off every day on the appropriate page of a very large casebook: A, how many moose appeared; B, what they ate; C, when they ate; D, how they ate; and E, anything unusual. Essentially, all he had to do was fill in the blanks, mostly with numbers and a few key words spelled out by the Forest Service in the introductory chapter. It was an almost foolproof system, and Colby had no difficulties with it at all, except in converting to nautical time. Nevertheless, by the time 2 weeks had passed, the young researcher was in desperate straits. His initial delight in the birch and the watercress had faded rapidly, the woods cutting off his view on three sides, while the lake glared or rippled at him on the fourth, had become oppressive, even fearsome. He waited with pathetic eagerness for the morning and evening sound of Amalgamated timber train and dreamed lustfully of the town square in Angora, a place he had previously scorned. When the head forest ranger, making his weekly run with supplies and advice, departed for the second time, Colby wept, cursed, and threw rocks into the lake. He almost threw his casebook into the lake. But being, if nothing else, docile to authority, he instead threw his copy of Walden into the bushes. It was the only reading matter he had brought along, except, and for this he rummaged fiercely among the empty potato chip bags and wet towels that littered his tent, What Colby was looking for was an Eastern Airlines throwaway with many cheerful pictures of civilization. Although he could not remember and would not have cared if he had, this particular issue was big on Holiday Inns. Placing the magazine next to the casebook, he took up his usual position on the beach, for it was now time for the moose, which he had come to hate bitterly, to begin their evening forage. That is how Colby established a routine which he was to stick to for the rest of the summer. Once he had finished his mandatory markings in the casebook, he picked up the magazine and, starting with the pictures, descended day by day through the larger typefaces to matters of lesser interest, such as the masthead. He generally finished just about the time the Ranger, Art Haynes, was due to appear with a replacement. Haynes, an understanding man with more than one young fellow in his charge, usually bought a Playboy or a penthouse, even an occasional Wii, though sometimes when all else failed, he showed up with a Woman's Day or Popular Mechanics. And once, coming late through Angora, was able to supply nothing but a pair of watchtowers. Colby didn't care. Whatever it was, he read it. And when he had finished, he threw it into the bushes. What Colby did not realize was that he was being watched at very close quarters by a moose, much closer than advised by the Forest Service. It was, in fact, a classical lineup, something like the domino theory, only in this case, not involving war. Picture the lake, full at certain hours of moose placidly feeding. Then picture the beach with Colby's magazines on it, and behind the magazines, Colby himself, propped up on the disguised and mysterious box. Picture the box leaning in its turn against the forest. Then you must change your direction, because intermingled with branches and overhanging Colby like a totem or trophy, a moose is peering out of its natural habitat. If you have pictured this, you have pictured it all until Colby's very last day. The animal in question was a direct descendant of the old moose. He had already done, and done well, for several winters and summers all that an average bull moose is expected to do. That apparently wasn't enough. Deep down, he must have been restless even before Colby showed up. But nobody knows for sure. And moose, who he eventually did learn to communicate after a fashion, has never indicated what it was that prompted him to sneak up on the young researcher. What moose got hit with, right through the heart, was Holiday Inns. The old neon arrow finished him off, so to speak, at least as a natural animal by any human definition. Perhaps it was the 20-story white donut at Waikiki with a rainforest growing up the middle. Or maybe it was the tan adobe job in Taos with real beams, shot at sundown as they always are. Those were the first in the magazine. Two-page spreads bleeding off in all directions, and Colby was so blinded by tears that he didn't turn the pages fast. In any case, for moose looking casually enough out of the fork of a nearby birch, the blurs must have resolved into colors, the colors into shapes, the shapes into images, and the images into love at first sight. By the time Colby recovered enough to move on to Tangiers in the Olympic rainforest, moose was already hooked. People will say, and they did say later on at the San Diego Zoo, that moose got imprinted. Maybe so, but it was late in his life for that, and it was certainly not your ordinary run-of-the-mill type imprint. Colby never knew it, of course. Sometimes he may have felt unexplained warm breezes on his back, that were actually Moose's own breathing as he forgot himself and leaned too close. At other times, terrified by the sound of cracking branches and heavy movements near his tent at night, he might have slept better if he had known it was not a bear, but only Moose trying to find that original eastern throwaway. He never did, though. It was under everything else except for Walden, and rain had pasted the pages shut. In a way, it didn't matter. Moose had the pictures in his mind. He ruminated and meditated, added people or automobiles, changed the time of day. Also, he drifted farther and farther away from the herd, knee-deep in anything. It was water lilies by the end of the summer. He would suddenly stop what he was doing and wander off, trying to see over the tops of the trees or to the end of the railroad track. Somewhere out there was a place where Holiday Inns are as thick as pines and the water bubbles bluer than the Maine sky. It was his daydreams, finally, that changed him. Moose's dreams had lots of white space and were often accompanied by blurbs, including reverse double burns in Helvetica and Garamond. No smudgy Xeroxes or cheap halftones ever crossed his awakening mind. He favored the hot side of the spectrum. Essentially, Moose had a Kodachrome mind, except for green, Holiday Inn green, a color no aspen, beech, or birch could match. It was the color of livery, and he sensed what that was, though he couldn't have named it. All he knew was that he was restless. He wanted to be standing at a glass door, a door as clear as Five Finger Lake in the Northwest Bay, where you can see turtles and waterlogged twigs 20 feet down, clear as the place where ice freezes black in winter. Moose looked in these places. He saw lobbies shaded in mystery, and lobbies grinting with promise, where an innkeeper in a green jacket leaned over a boulder and smiled at him. He also dreamed about people. He had seen a fair amount of these in his day, railroad men, forest rangers, a stray camper or two. But he did not think the people who lurked around Five Finger Lake were the real McCoy. The ones he dreamed about were a different lot entirely. Their eyes gazed directly at him like it was mating season. They had good teeth, riding their bicycles, bouncing beach balls, or leaning simply and confidently against furniture. They were all going in Moose's dreams to the Holiday Inn. Men in espadrilles and wallaby weavers, women not wearing anything at all, and children too, most of them coming out of the rear ends of station wagons. In his dream, Moose was in the midst of these people, gambling, tossing his antlers. He was running with them across fluorescent meadows towards a glass door under a pink and white star. So things continued until Colby's last day. It was late afternoon. It was hot. At first, Colby thought he was seeing the shadow of some very thick branches, but he knew even before the jab of fear hit him in the stomach that he was not dealing with a tree. There were many more warnings in the manual about taking survey subjects for granted. This included moose, also deer, buffalo, elk, stray cattle, and mink, the latter because of the possibility of rabies. Colby knew there was a moose standing behind him and had a horror of being bitten in the neck, though reason told him he would probably be gored or trampled to death. He felt that when he turned his head, he would be looking into his doom, but what else could he do? There was a moment of silence. Moose looked at Colby. Colby looked at Moose. Their distance from each other was determined by Moose's long, drooping nose, typical, as we all know, of the species. Neither of them was prepared for the meeting, though Colby was perhaps the less prepared of the two. He could not find a suitable expression for his face. He felt self-consciously that it was doing things completely beyond his control. The truth is, they just stared at each other rather stupidly for several minutes. Then Moose stepped with a great cracking of branches over the fork of the birch, cocking his head to get his antlers through. Colby shut his eyes. He thought it would be better to meet death that way. A half a ton, the manual had said, or more. The Alaskan moose, he remembered, is even bigger, while a rabid or insane moose is not mentioned at all. The next thing Colby knew, the animal was standing in front of him, its head bowed almost to the ground. It seemed to be making a deep obeisance. Actually, Moose was smelling Colby's copy of Playboy, something he had always wanted to do. Raising his head, he gazed at the young man one more time. Then he turned and walked into the lake. Colby watched until Moose rounded a bend in the inlet and was lost to him. For a long time, he sat on the beach, transfixed. This is the kind of opportunity Colby's parents had been hoping for. Did he take advantage of it? Did he grab the casebook and work far into the night with a flashlight and stubby pencil, doing justice to item E? If he had, both Colby's life and Moose's might have been different. And there probably would have been some changes in the Forest Service, too. Certainly for the survey director, Morris J. Harrison, author of Managing the Maine Moose. But Harrison never did get a chance to try for the big time. And Colby, instead of moving into a position of prominence as a student of animal behavior, almost got himself killed. What he did was the last thing you should ever do. It was so stupid, it is not even mentioned in the manual. As soon as the herd arrived at its regular feeding place, Colby waded in. Leaping and splashing from animal to animal, he called joyously to his new friend. Moose, of course, was not there. He was on an island waiting for the evening star. But the old regulars were, plus a few new arrivals. For it was getting towards September, a time when moose gather to rut and are unusually short-tempered and defensive. They made warning signs, lowerings, shakings of antlers, exposing of teeth. Colby, laughing deliriously, knew them all, or should have. He'd read about them enough, but he paid no attention. Most people would not have been affected by an animal in quite that same way. Colby, however, was an extremely diffident person, so diffident that he never acted shy or timid for fear it would cause trouble. He was a melder. He blended into things. In the game of life, he kept his eyes on the ball, not on the other players or the scenery outside the white lines. And he was careful not to be too good a player either. For this reason, he had not looked into anyone's eyes since he was 6 years old. That was where the trouble started. Moose eyes in general are brown, turned down at the corners, and amazingly human in appearance. Looking into a moose's eyes, Colby felt strange sensations. You might say that if the world is divided up like a pie, Colby and anyone else used to being in the section reserved for humans would be surprised to find themselves in some other section or walking between two sections on a very thin line. If you said that, you would be right, but Colby would not have admitted it. He hated pie graphs. Because of snowballing reforms in his school district, he had been hit with pie graphs every year from the time he was in second grade. The reason he went to Princeton and became a lit major was to escape them. So if Colby lived in such a sliced-up world as the one suggested above, he would never have said so. It would have made him sick to his stomach to think of such a thing. For Colby, it was more like looking out. That's what he would have said. Always he was looking out at things. And, of course, looking out for himself. He was looking out at Moose. He almost got cross-eyed from doing it. But being at such close quarters, he also inhaled, and it changed him. Moose had been eating water lilies. That day, as every day, he got down a couple of bushels, though he fed alone now, not with the others. There was probably too much chlorophyll on his breath, though it might have been a fungus or some rare element in the lake water. Maybe it was something deeper out of Moose's dead spaces, or an alveolar exhalation as yet unknown to zoologists. At any rate, Colby began to get powerful feelings in his body, particularly along the backbone. It was the first time he really perceived he had a backbone. Something was waking up. It woke up in his mind and in all the other parts of his body at once. This made him foolhardy. It took Colby far too long to realize these were the wrong moose. These moose moved towards him, stretching and retracting their necks. There was something snake-like about this. Colby stared, fascinated. Clicking noises came from their throats, and their ears were laid back. The lake rippled as they advanced, lead-colored with tips of white foam. Standing awkwardly and suddenly cold in the water, Colby searched for a sign of recognition. He saw towering humps. He smelled wet fur. He felt his own thundering heart. Antlers surrounded him. He looked into alien eyes. There was no time to think. Colby took a deep breath and submerged. For a while, it was touch and go as he writhed between legs and underbellies, digging his fingers into the lake floor. Large, sharp hoofs struck at him. Several times he narrowly missed being stomped into the muck. Once, rising unintentionally to the surface, he was bitten hard, butted, kicked, and speared. He felt his way along the bottom, seeking concealment and anchorage under lily pads. Occasionally, he became entangled in thin, rope-like vines. Colby survived only because he had wasted his summers at the country club swimming pool and was good at holding his breath. It was one of the few things he did with conviction. Finding shelter between two submerged boulders, he managed to propel himself into some cattails on the shore side and raise his head above water at last. Blue in the face, bruised and bleeding, he crawled back to his tent. The moose were gone. He saw nothing but water and stars. That night, he slept fitfully, awakened again and again by a sense that animals were alive inside of him. Particularly when he breathed, he could feel something moving back and forth, a lion, maybe, or a moose. The next day, he turned in his casebook to Art Hanks, who noticed no change in him at all, except that he was cleaner than he had been in weeks. Colby left Five Finger Lake in Haynes's Jeep. He did not look back. He didn't have to. Well, that's how Moose gets into Holiday Inns. And after Colby leaves, Moose does get out of the woods. He hitches a freight train and ends up on a used car lot with a plastic reindeer display in Newark, New Jersey. And there, a 65-year-old salesman named Lewis Feldman takes him under his wing, and they do visit many Holiday Inns. Often in disguise, Feldman covers Moose up with a sheet, and then he pushes him around as if Moose were a laundry basket. But finally, they go to Las Vegas, and there, By a quirk of fate, Moose becomes a star, a national celebrity. He is hired as a mascot by the Dallas Cowboys. And I'm going to read you the section of Moose's debut with the Cowboys. Most of the names in here are as unfamiliar to Moose as they would be to you. Feldman is his old pal, and one other name that you should remember is there's a young man named Perlito who is acting kind of as Moose's and Feldman's consultant. He's a former lobbyist for the Illinois State Chamber of Commerce. And we don't trust him. So this is, and Moose has begun to learn it's not all easy to be a star, okay? Chew on his ear, said young Sam Hopp. Sam himself was chewing on a hunk of pitcher's gum and sitting on top of the handicap stall in the Texas Stadium's public lavatory. Below him, three security people and a vet were trying to give Moose an enema. Their names were Oscar LaVie, Rafe Hutchins, Janet Cross, and Dr. George Trowbridge. Feldman did not know anything about it. He was in conference room C of the Dallas Hilton meeting the press. If Feldman had known, there would have been trouble. Perlito had told them as much. Moose had just kicked Dr. Trowbridge. Now he wheeled. Now he backed up against the toilet, guarding the door. The security people dodged his antlers. He had them covered. Moose pawed the floor. Roots, dirt, brush. That's what he was feeling for. His titanium shoes rang on the tiles. Sparks flew. Sam swallowed his gum and eased himself along the top of the stall. Flipping over on his belly, he reached through a veritable flotilla of antlers in search of an ear. Moose's eyes rolled back. His hair stood out like a porcupine's. He tried to scrape Sam off the wall. Sam retreated. Hold my legs, he said to Janet. I'm going down. Janet, standing on the seat in the adjacent stall, obliged. I thought this animal was tame, muttered Trowbridge. At this moment, Moose was certainly not tame. He was angry. You could say he was seeing red, but that would be wrong. He wasn't seeing colors at all. He was seeing black and white. He was seeing gray. He was smelling danger. It had hard edges, weight, and dimension. Moose had regressed. Those other moose, the ones who had almost done away with Colby, would have been proud of him. Moose backed up. He felt the wall against his flank, cold. He compressed himself like a spring. He was getting ready to charge. Shut the door, yelled Sam. They put their backs against it. They braced their feet on the washstands. Oscar, Rafe, and Trowbridge, three men just trying to earn a living, pitted against 1,000 pounds of meat, muscle, nerve, and hard bone. The stall shook like a pressure cooker. There was thumping and ringing noises inside. Now the door was bowing out. A hinge was off. Another. Now it was opening. A half inch, an inch. Oscar's foot slipped. Before he could recover his leverage, Moose had his head out and was sinking his teeth into Oscar's shoulder. Oscar yelled. Janet recoiled. Sam, angling for an ear, slipped out of her grasp. Sam was standing suddenly on his hands, clinging to the roots of Moose's antlers. His forehead bumped against Moose's skull. Moose shook his head up and down. Sam and Oscar rose and fell. Janet, perched on top of the stall, tried to get a hold on Sam's belt. Rafe punched Moose in the nose with Trowbridge's suitcase. Moose knocked Rafe over and stomped on Trowbridge's fingers. He did not let go of Oscar. The suitcase spun across the floor. Perlito, bursting in, almost tripped on it. What the hell's going on here, he asked. The truth is, Perlito knew quite well what was going on, though he didn't approve of it. None of this is necessary, you know. That's what he kept telling them up in the office. But all they had said was, you take care of Feldman. "There's a man trapped in there," yelled Trowbridge. He was going for a suitcase. The noise was so bad, Perlito could hardly hear him. "No tranquilizer," shouted Perlito. "This animal's got to perform." "Do something, asshole, or Sam's dead," screamed Janet. Perlito grabbed Moose's ear. He put it in his mouth. He chewed gently. "It's like an initiation," he whispered, the hairs tickling his throat. Perlito had never been initiated, not since Boy Scouts. Tears came into his eyes. "Yeah," he whispered to Moose, "it's an initiation. You'll learn from it. It'll make you a better man, a better moose." Moose relaxed his grip on Oscar. Perlito, leaning close, could feel his heart beating. The blood pressure must be god-awful. Moose was trembling all over and slick with sweat. Young Sam, meanwhile, with Janet's help, had righted himself and gotten a hand over the top of the stall. "Way to go," he told Perlito admiringly. "Moose," whispered Perlito. "Moose, do you hear me?" He wasn't chewing on the ear anymore. He was holding Moose by the dewlap, looking deep into his right eye. "Moose, I never said it would be easy. If you want to go back to the woods, okay. If you want to go back to Feldman, okay. Know what I mean? And Feldman would be happy, right? But would he be proud of you? Moose, you have to ask that question. Would Feldman be proud?" Moose's right eye looked anxiously at Perlito. What the left one was doing, Perlito couldn't tell. "Do you want to be part of the cowboy organization?" Perlito asked. Moose nodded. "Then you've got to do this and take it like a man." Okay, the last section I'll read you is the actual halftime where Moose does his performance. And the only person you got to know in here is Elsa Onyx, who's a 40-year-old chorus girl and champion lariat thrower from Las Vegas, knows Moose previously. And Elsa's horse is named Betsy. "Look down into the Texas stadium, a blimp shot. There it sits like a dish. There's the green rectangle of astroturf, and there are the stands filled to the brim with people. At this distance, they look like some kind of exotic mold. On the north end of the field, a small figure emerges from the sheltering bleachers. It is a moose. It is our moose. His bladder is empty. His bowels are as clean as a whistle. His hooves have been polished, his hair shampooed. He poses no threat to the field or to the sensibilities of fans and home viewers. This is a serious matter. We are dealing with close-ups and instant replay. We are dealing with eidetic essences here. There is no place for crud. Moose's antlers have been rubbed clean of every last bit of moss. They have been polished with a chamois by Sam Hopp himself. They are a sight to behold. A 54-inch spread of softly shining prongs and scallops. Shaved and lathed, prepped and polished, wheeled down the corridor to the operating room where the surgeons wait under the big lamps. But of course, no one is wheeling Moose anywhere. He has walked on his own legs through a tunnel to the light at the end of it, and now he's striding toward the 50-yard line under the bright Dallas sun. The astroturf squeaks under his hoofs. He likes the sound. He has learned the right to hear it. He has come through with flying colors, Perlito's words. Oscar has forgiven him. Even Dr. Trowbridge has said, "Good boy." Moose stands on the 50-yard line in the middle of the NFL symbol. He tests the wind, checks his back trail. There is something so simple about this, so dignified, The fans burst into spontaneous applause. Moose ends this opening sequence by taking the famous Remington stance, head lifted, nostrils flaring, legs slightly apart. As he does this, the haunting notes of Debussy's Afternoon of a Faun drift through the stadium. The UT band has entered on tiptoe and is in formation behind the visitors' goalposts. Now the cowgirls come in. They are doing a two-step, three-point turn combination, leading with their hips. The cowgirls circle, they gather, they cluster around Moose. They do a bottoms up. The audience gasps. The girls are wearing blue panties with pink and white water hyacinths attached. They have turned into a pond, a pure blue main pond. Moose is in the middle, swimming and browsing. There is a disturbance over at the north tunnel. The clatter of hoofs, the rapid fire of a six-shooter. The music stops. Elsa and Bitsy come out running, Elsa reining in under the visitors' goalposts. Bitsy rears. Elsa spins a few butterfly loops and a couple of rollovers. The cowgirls stand up brandishing green pom-poms. They look at Elsa and Bitsy. They look at Moose. With their pom-poms, they create a giant wigwam over Moose. But it is not to be. Moose wants out. Bowing to his wishes, the cowgirls fling down their pom-poms one by one and face the goalposts on bended knee. Their eyes are focused on something far away, beyond Moose, beyond Elsa and Bitsy, beyond the tiers of seats in the stadium, maybe beyond the horizon itself. They have an androgynous look on their faces. This does not bother the people in the stadium, but the fans back home, seeing in their close-ups, are confused. As the band strikes up with the William Tell Overture, Moose gallops to meet Elsa. Actually, he's not galloping. He's doing a typical ground-eating, long-strided trot, especially useful on tundra. Bitsy is not galloping either. She's doing a high-stepping canter. Otherwise, they would have collided on the 30-yard line. For the act, Elsa is wearing white leather chaps decorated with Texas stars in red, blue, and silver beadwork. Underneath the chap, she wears a flesh-colored bikini. Her bolero is navy blue velvet. She has a white Stetson with teal feather brim band and blue buckskin gauntlets heavily fringed. With her hair and braids rolled conch shell style at her ear, she looks like one powerful Apache chisquera, though she is really black Irish and afraid of the dark, except when riding a horse. And Elsa is riding a horse, hell-bent for leather towards Moose. She grasps the rope on the saddle horn and throws out a loop to be ready. She is using medium-weight braid with a heavy aluminum Honda, not recommended for amateurs. She raises her arm. She spins. The rope circles above her head. Moose slides to a halt. You can hear the screech of his haunches on the turf all the way up to the top of the stands. It looks like Elsa's going to get him on her first try, but it's all a fake. She's spinning, not throwing. Moose scrambles to his feet and gallops, this time for real, around the field's perimeter. When he passes the UT honor guard, they dip their flags. Elsa, in hot pursuit, almost tramples him. The fans boo. She gains on Moose by the Dallas cowpost, which they use for a difficult zigzag routine. Both Moose and Bitsy are pivoting on their rear legs into 90-degree turns. Elsa is leaning way out on the saddle. You can't see her from the far side, only her boot. Moose's antlers are inches from the ground. It's very dangerous, and everybody knows it. Moose makes a break down the middle of the field. He is heading for the cowgirls who have been doing high kicks and hoedowns on the 50-yard line. Elsa is right behind him, spinning again. Suddenly, the cowgirls kneel, crossing their pom-poms, and Moose does a standing jump over the first row. That jump is an incredible thing to see. It brings Feldman to his feet and Perlito too, even though both have watched it before. The first time Moose did this jump, during dress rehearsal as a spontaneous afterthought, they all went out to disco derby and celebrated. On this day, the fans are throwing cushions, paper cups, and flowers on the field. and they don't stop. Now comes the fun part, especially designed by Perlito for telescopic. The cowgirls, again, are sheltering Moose. He is completely hidden in a green grove of pom-poms. Everyone is entranced. The cowgirls sweep the pom-poms to the ground in graceful body arcs. Moose pops into view like a jack-in-the-box. Elsa makes a dash for him. Now you see him, now you don't. Elsa circles, hunting for a way in. Bitsy's eyes are darting to and fro. Elsa is keeping her seat beautifully. Horse people appreciate what she is doing. It is lost on the others. She is getting booed. Moose rushes out of the forest. Over by the cowboy bench, the head coach beckons him on. This was Perlito's idea. Moose is heading for the bench. The cowboys are cheering for him. Can he make it? Will the team protect him? You're damn right they will. But Elsa is too quick for him. Taking the diagonal to Moose's right angle, she speeds along, waltzing sadly across the turf with poignant right and left lunges. Elsa is swinging the rope. The loop dilates. It grows into a monstrous circle 15 feet in diameter. She makes a quick motion with her right arm. The rope snakes through the air. The loop settles in terrible slow motion, it seems to Feldman and many others that day, over Moose's antlers. He plunges like a caught sturgeon. Bitsy slides on her haunches. The loop is tight. It is around his neck. They have him. Moose is caught. But he does not fall. Elsa does not flip him over on his back like a steer, nor does she come over and grab his nose as though she were an ordinary bronco buster. Instead, Moose remains standing, an incredible feat in itself. Perfectly synchronized, he and Bitsy come to their respective halts, the rope taut between them. Elsa dismounts and walks to Moose's side, her hand lightly on the Rialto. They do not take a bow. They simply stand there in dignified submission. That is what they are doing when the Branders come out. Third-generation professionals from Greer County, Oklahoma. The coals in the portable barbecue grill are white-hot. So are the irons. Do you understand what's going to happen here? Perlito had asked Feldman way back at the beginning. Perlito was nothing if not a pro. Feldman understood. So did Moose. It was total free will. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Coming into the field now as witnesses are Feldman, Perlito, the owners of the cowboy organization, the head coach of the cowboys, the head coach of the cowgirls, the mayor of Dallas, and the vice president of the United States. The captain of the cowboys and two men from the offensive team, two from the defense, serve as Moose's honor guard. There is a puff of smoke, a smell of burning hair, and a slight sizzle. It is all over in a few seconds. Moose never flinched. To make a long story short, they ran a fast brand on his right haunch, the Dallas Big D in a box. And that's it.